طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we feature Allison Weir, founder and director of the organization If Americans Knew. This presentation was given in Natick, Massachusetts. Allison Weir is one of those curious people who, when confronted with what was happening in Israel-Palestine, and knowing very little, decided to go over there to see for herself. She was so disturbed and moved by what she saw and learned that she came back and founded her organization, the mission of which is to educate Americans concerning the conditions in Palestine. Allison Weir's talk is too long to broadcast in its entirety, and so is edited for this broadcast. What has been omitted is some of the description of her first trip, so the talk begins with her coming back from her trip and deciding to found the organization If Americans Knew.
And so when I came back from that first trip, I started an organization to give Americans the facts on this issue, all Americans, and I named it If Americans Knew. We especially focus on the media. I feel that in a democracy, in a republic, the most powerful institution is the news media. That is how we learn what we think we know about many issues, especially international issues. So we decided to do some studies on the media. My son is a scientist. I like the idea of choosing some a category that would be acknowledged as significant and that was quantifiable, as immune to subjective bias as possible. So we chose to look at how the media covered deaths among both populations. We especially, in one of our studies, focused on the first year of the uprising because first impressions are so powerful. We then looked at a subcategory category that's especially troubling, the killing of children. I think that we're all deeply saddened when we hear that a child has been killed, regardless of their race, religion, ethnicity, or nationality. I think we're deeply saddened. Children are not supposed to be killed. But they are being killed. So we need to answer this very sad question. Using an Israeli source, we discovered that 28 Israeli children had tragically been killed by Palestinians, and 131 Palestinian children had tragically been killed by Israelis. How were these deaths covered? How many of them were covered by the primetime network news shows? Well, we found that they had reported on Israeli children's deaths at rates up to 13 and 14 times greater than they reported on Palestinian children's deaths. Some of you are probably noticing they're over 100%. We were counting every time there was a report on a child's death. So we knew there would at times perhaps be follow-up reports. We were astounded to find that the news coverage of Israeli deaths in general is usually over 100%. And for Palestinians, it's never even close. Then in our study of the New York Times, and all of this is on our website in greater detail, in our study of the New York Times, we decided to graph our data chronologically for that first year just to see what that would look like. So we'll show you this next slide will be the curve of the New York Times reporting on Israeli children killed that first year, first 12 months. Then we'll see the actual death curve of Israeli children that first year, which is the light blue line. It's a little bit lower, as the New York Times had not follow-up reports on Israeli children, but it's a very similar curve. Next, we'll see the New York Times reporting on Palestinian children that first year. It's the red line, a little bit lower, but right along the same curve, interestingly. Then we'll see the actual death curve of Palestinian children killed that first year. And this is it. Many people will tell me that they do feel well-informed on Israel-Palestine because they listen to NPR. Pro-Israel organizations have frequently attacked NPR as allegedly being pro-Palestinian in their coverage. They've caused financial damage to some NPR affiliates around the country, including, I think, here in Boston. So an organization called Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, a well-regarded media watchdog group that does studies of media coverage on many issues, decided to look into NPR's coverage of Israel-Palestine. Their researcher, Seth Ackerman, did an excellent study, and he found that, yes, indeed, NPR is quite distorted on their coverage in this issue. But once again, it's actually in a pro-Israel direction. He gave his study a brilliant title. He called it The Illusion of Balance, because he found that NPR was carrying almost the exact same number of stories on Israeli children and on Palestinian children. It looked just the same. So to many people, that seemed like objective, balanced, neutral reporting. In reality, that wasn't balance, that was distortion. I would suggest that was manipulation. That meant they were reporting on almost all the deaths among one population and a small percentage of the deaths among another population. Throughout the past 15 years, every so often when there is Palestinian lethal violence against Israelis, we're frequently told that a calm has been shattered and then Israel responds. So we always hear that Palestinians have shattered a period of calm with their violence. There is a headline of that sort on the Los Angeles Times website in 2005. In late afternoon, early evening, I saw it there, many hours before the newspaper would actually be printed. So I called them up because I thought they would not want to print an inaccurate headline. And I told them that during what they were saying was a period of calm, that 170 Palestinian men, women, and children had been killed. And that during a period they were saying was calm, 379 had been injured. Their response to me was, we said relative calm. And they didn't change a single word in their story or add any of this easily verifiable information. There are so many omissions, I cannot come near giving all of them, but I'll give a few that I think are especially important. There is dissent in Israel. There are various sorts of groups, religious, secular, rabbis' groups, women's groups, of all sorts that are very many military soldiers refusing to serve in occupation, etc. There is considerable dissent in Israel. It's a small percentage of the population, but it is a significant phenomenon, and yet almost no Americans know what's going on. Similarly, many people will say, if only the Palestinians would use nonviolence. They say that because the media almost never tell people that the Palestinians use nonviolence every week, literally. In fact, often there are one or two or three nonviolent demonstrations every single week in the West Bank and in Gaza. Often by farmers, often in small villages. And yet we're almost never told about that. And this is an extraordinary phenomenon. In a number of cases, people from around the world, of all ages, backgrounds, and ethnicities, are coming in and joining this nonviolence movement, including some Israelis. And it's an extremely courageous activity to engage in, because it is almost always, I think always, met with extreme violence by Israeli troops. Many people have been killed and injured taking part in these activities. Most of them are Palestinian. But some of them have been Americans and foreigners. Rachel Corey was 23 years old when she was killed. Tom Herndon was 21 years old when he was killed. Many others have been injured. Tristan Anderson is brain damaged and in a wheelchair. Brian Avery is having his face reconstructed, etc. But we almost never are told about that. Another omission of a very different sort occurred in 2003. This wasn't far away on the other side of the world. This was something that happened in the United States, in Washington, D.C., on Capitol Hill. There was a report by the Independent Commission on the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty on Capitol Hill. It was chaired by a retired four-star admiral who had been chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Also on that panel, on Capitol Hill, was a rear admiral. And not just any rear admiral, this man had been in charge of the whole legal department of the U.S. Navy. Also part of that commission was a Marine general. And not just any Marine general, this man was the highest ranking Congressional Medal of Honor recipient in the United States of America. They announced their findings that Israel had attacked a U.S. Navy ship, that they had tried to sink it, that they had killed 34 Americans and injured over 170 of them. They announced that rescue flights to these men had been recalled by order of the President of the United States. They announced that this had constituted an act of war by Israel against the United States. They also announced that this had been ordered covered up by the President of the United States. Statements of that magnitude, made by officials of that high rank on Capitol Hill, are newsworthy. And yet there was nothing about it in the Washington Post, on Fox News, USA Today. About the only place you could read about it was the Stars and Stripes newspaper, the military newspaper abroad. And in the Congressional Record, it's there in detail. Now let's look at the recent Israel-Gaza wars, as our media call them. Let's look at the fatalities on both sides, and we'll look at the one in 2008-09 that was over Christmas vacation. Perhaps some people didn't notice it. It's a very busy, special time for many of us. So here is the war of 2008-09. Those are the deaths on both sides, inflicted by the other. As I'm sure you're aware, that's not what a war looks like. That's what a massacre looks like. And then let's look at the one that took place summer before last, 2014. Now, in that war, all of the media coverage started the sequence of events that led to that war with the abduction of three young Israelis in June who were abducted and tragically murdered. That's where they begin the sequence that then, they say, led to the war of the summer of 2014. Well, let's care about all people. Both populations matter. All human beings matter. Let's look at the deaths among both populations from the beginning of 2014. And we see that in January, some Palestinians had been killed, including a child. But apparently that's not worth mentioning. Then let's look at the next month, and we see, more Palestinians have been killed, but apparently not worth mentioning. Then we look at the next month, and still more Palestinians were killed, including another child. Then we look at April, and there was an Israeli soldier, and another Palestinian was killed. Then we look at the next month, May, and we see still more Palestinians were killed, including two children. But apparently none of this is newsworthy or worthy of mention. Then we get to June and we see the three Israelis. And then the media pay attention, and that is supposedly where the violence began. And then we see the next month, and that's what it looked like. As I mentioned, the news coverage always focuses on the three Israelis who were kidnapped. Well, again, there was a great deal of news coverage on them. We learned their names, we were concerned for what had happened to them. Well, let's again care about all people and look at the situation for both populations. Were any Palestinians perhaps abducted also? And let's look just from the beginning of 2014 through June to see if any Palestinians were forcibly abducted and imprisoned. And yes, over 2,000 Palestinians but we only heard about 3 Israelis. And then let's look at the aftermath. Usually when there's a hurricane or a tsunami or an earthquake, we then see the people afterwards trying to rebuild their lives, their difficulties. Our hearts go out to them. Many times people send them aid, sometimes go to help. Well, in this case, we had over 100,000 people in Gaza made homeless. Thousands of people injured in a place where most of the hospitals had been destroyed or damaged. In a region where they were already under a blockade by Israel, and already many medications were scarce or non-existent, just normal medications. Even some of the things you need in an operating room were very scarce, even before the war. And yet, this also is apparently not newsworthy and gets little notice. When I began to look into this issue back in 2001, early 2001, I wondered, well, where did this violence come from? How did it start? What is it all about? And I began to read. And one of the first things that I learned was that when I was born, there was no Israel. When I was born, there was Palestine. At that time, it was under the British Empire. So where did this violence come from, and where did Israel come from? Well, many people are led to believe by the media that this violence has been going on for thousands of years. They've just been killing each other. Well, actually, if you look at Palestine, in the late 1800s, it was under the Ottoman Empire at that time, you discover that it was at peace. That it was, in some ways, what we would call a multicultural population. And there was about 80% Muslim, about 15% Christian, and a little under 5% Jewish, all living together in harmony, as they had done for centuries. So where did the conflict and the violence come from? To understand that, you don't look in the region. It did not originate in that region. It began with a political ideology and movement in Europe, and soon in the United States, called political Zionism. This was a movement to create a Jewish state in Palestine. For a while, they considered a Jewish state in Argentina or Uganda, one or two other places, but very quickly, political Zionism was defined as a movement to create a Jewish state in Palestine in the late 1800s. Even though that meant that that would be dispossessing 95% of the inhabitants. But as I said, I'm focusing on the U.S., and it was very active in the United States since the late 1800s. I had no idea this had been going on. What shocked me with my research and when I was writing my book is that Zionism, political Zionism, has profoundly impacted our nation negatively. It has profoundly impacted the Middle East tragically, and it has profoundly impacted the whole world dangerously, with instability of all sorts. And yet, most Americans have never heard about it. If we went to ask the average person, what do you think of Zionism? Zionists, how do you define it? Most people, I feel strongly, would say what I probably would have said about 16 years ago. I probably would have said something like, I think I've heard that word. What does it mean? We've all heard of socialism, capitalism, communism, and yet this is a significant ideology that we don't even know about, most of us. In 1910, there were already 20,000 Zionists in the United States. They included lawyers, professors, businessmen. It was already, in the words of one historian, becoming a movement to which congressmen listened in 1910, especially in the large cities, probably this one. In 1914, there was an especially significant development. World Zionism, which I had not even known existed before, World Zionism moved to the United States in 1914, and the leader of World Zionism became Louis Brandeis, a prominent Boston attorney. In 1916, Mr. Brandeis became a Supreme Court justice. He is an especially well-known and highly regarded Supreme Court justice. I think most of us, if we try to think about name Supreme Court justices from the past century, I don't think we could name very many. But I think many of us could name Louis Brandeis. And yet I suspect that many of us don't know he was the head of World Zionism. What it turns out that the common practice when one is named to the Supreme Court is to resign from your affiliations, board memberships, etc., so that you'll be neutral. There won't be any conflict of interest if you resign those things. So Louis Brandeis resigned his leadership of World Zionism outwardly, but in reality, he continued to lead it. This is mentioned in a number of books. His loyal lieutenants would come into his Supreme Court chambers, report on what they were doing, and he would give them directives in his Supreme Court chambers to go and carry out. I was shocked to learn that. That, of course, is highly improper, which is probably one of the reasons that he kept it secret. But, of course, you also sometimes it's more effective when you do things secretly. Well, then I learned something even more astounding. So I'll give you my source. If you do get my book, and I hope you do, you'll see that it's literally over half citation. So everything I'm saying, you could look at my source for. But I'll give you the citation for this next information because it is truly quite astonishing. What I was doing was looking for books on this issue that looked like they would be factual and reliable. I would read those books, and then I would look at the footnotes to see where specific information had come from, get the books from those footnotes quite often, read those books, look at those footnotes, and on and on. One of the books that I read, it was an especially mainstream book called Israel in the Mind of America, published by a very mainstream publisher. The author is a very establishment author named Peter Gross, who tilts towards Israel. He definitely tilts more towards Israel than to the Palestinians. He was diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times, and then he was at Harvard for a number of years. He wrote several well-regarded nonfiction books. Well, in his book, he said that Louis Brandeis had been the leader of a secret Zionist society that had operated in the United States. I was shocked to read such a thing. So, of course, I looked at the footnote to see where that information had come from, and I discovered it was from a scholarly journal, the American Jewish Historical Quarterly, an article published in 1975, The Parachute, a Secret Episode in American Zionist History. So then I looked into, well, who wrote that article? Is this a reliable author? I assume that their articles are peer-reviewed, but I still wondered who wrote it. Is this someone that seems to have the credentials to write on such a topic? Well, it turned out that it was an Israeli professor from a mainstream Israeli university, Dr. Sarah Schmidt. Her field of expertise is Zionism, especially American Zionism. She was the author. And in this book, she wrote that Zionism, that the Parashim, was an elitist secret society. It was the Hebrew word for Pharisees and separate. The members spread across the land. They worked to plant ideas and to influence people, especially at high levels of government. They recruited people of all sorts, especially Harvard students were recruited quite a bit because Brandeis had a number of connections to Harvard. And there was even an induction ceremony when someone joined the Parashim in which they swore that their devotion to Zionism would exceed their devotion to family, school, nation. And a Supreme Court justice was a member of this. In fact, it appears that Felix Frankfurter probably also was. In 1915, a member of the Parashim, in fact a leader, suggested that the British might gain benefit from a declaration in support of a Jewish national homeland in Palestine. Those of you who have heard of the Balfour Declaration may be connecting this up. But for those of you who may not know that, as I would not have, may be wondering, what does this mean? Why would the British have anything to do with Palestine and with a declaration about a Jewish homeland in Palestine? Because as I mentioned, in 1915, Palestine was still under the Ottoman Empire. huge as the British Empire was, it did not include Palestine. So what would they get out of this? Why would they want to do that? Well, let's remember what was going on in 1915. It was what they called at that time the Great War. This was a, you know, as you know, massive carnage and bloodshed. And the British were in danger of losing that war. In the first day of the Battle of the Somme, a battle that went on for months, British casualties were 60,000 men in one day of battle. So they were desperate for the U.S. to come in on their side. The Germans also wanted the U.S. to come in on the German side. But the American public, being that apparently bad thing, were what's called isolationists. They didn't want to go to join a foreign war to kill and be killed for something that had nothing to do with them, a war that most people feel was pointless. Woodrow Wilson was even elected to a second term of office with the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." But to the Zionists, especially the British Zionists, named Chaim Weizmann, who later became president of Israel, Chaim Weizmann, who was in Britain, went to the British government in their desperation and claimed that the Zionists could influence the U.S. to come into the war on the side of Britain through their colleagues in the United States. They specifically mentioned Louis Brandeis, who was close to Woodrow Wilson. So they claimed that they could do that and that they would do that if the British government would then assure them that they would facilitate their Zionist project to colonize Palestine and to take it over for a Jewish state. This is how they got the Balfour Declaration. It's mentioned in a number of books. It was called the Gentlemen's Agreement, sort of a quid pro quo. And from this agreement, the British did indeed issue a declaration called the Balfour Declaration. It's fairly mild. But it says that the British government would view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, as long as it did not prejudice some of the rights of the non-Jewish communities in Palestine, which were 90% of Palestine. By the way, this declaration, which mild as it may sound, is considered quite significant because it sort of opened the door, cracked open the door, to the British support for Zionism. The Balfour Declaration, by the way, was not written by Lord Balfour, who was the foreign minister of Britain. It was actually written by a secret Zionist, and his name is in my book. And the text of the Balfour Declaration, as it's called, went back and forth between the United States and Britain. And by the way, this was a letter to Lord Rothschild, who was another Zionist leader in Britain. After the war, there was the Paris Peace Conference in which the winners divided up the spoils, and the British were put in charge of Palestine. They were given the mandate, it was called, over Palestine, and the Balfour language was then put into the mandate. So then immigration to Palestine greatly increased, and not surprisingly, sadly, but not surprisingly, it led to violent conflict. Indigenous populations do not want to be pushed out. So there was increasing violence. Innocent lives on both sides, then as now, were lost. Then as now, the large majority were the Palestinian Christians and Muslims. The Zionists formed two terror groups called the Irgun and the Stern Gang. The leaders of these groups later became Israeli prime ministers. In fact, one of them, Menachem Begin, at one point bragged that they had. He was asked, how does it feel later? Journalists asked Menachem Begin, how does it feel to have introduced terrorism to the Middle East? And Begin responded, to the world. But I'm focusing on the American aspect, and it turns out there were a number of groups in the United States connected to those terror groups that were funneling them money and weaponry. One of the main ones was a man named Hillel Cook. In the United States, he went by the name Peter Bergson. He formed a number of groups with deceptive names. He was the Irgun operative in the United States. There's a whole book that tells about this. Another man who was connected with one of the terror gangs in what was called Palestine at that time, for the Zionists, was connected to the Stern Gang, and his name was Rabbi Baruch Korf. I believe he was from Boston. His father was a very prominent rabbi in Boston. So Baruch Korf was connected to the Stern Gang. In 1947, he was in Paris. Now, the British government periodically through the years there was so much violent conflict in Palestine because of this Jewish colonization and Zionist plan to take it over, that they would periodically see there's all this violence. I wonder why. If they would do a white paper and they'd say, oh, because the Zionists are taking over the land and the people don't like that. So then they would issue a white paper and they would sometimes restrict the immigration for a period of time. So then the Zionists would hate the British and kill the British. So in 1947, the British were restricting the immigration, the Zionist immigration to Palestine. So the Zionists hated the British, even though the British had just fought and defeated Adolf Hitler. So Korf and his group in Paris decided that they would get an airplane, they would make bombs, and they would fly over London and drop bombs on the British Foreign Ministry. They had the money. They had a plane. They were missing one thing. They did not know how to fly the plane. So then they then recruited a young American aviator who was in Paris, who had been an ace during World War II, to fly the plane for him. His name was Reginald Gilbert. Gilbert pretended to go along with the plot, but then he secretly went to the American embassy. They went to the Paris police and the Scotland Yard eventually, and the plot was foiled, and Korf was arrested and held for a while, but eventually released. He had very powerful friends in the United States, including, as I mentioned, his father. At his father's funeral, the mayor of Boston had come. So Korf got off, and nothing happened. There were no consequences. I was very curious about what about him, because he's really not mentioned in other books. In fact, none of this episode is in any other book that I'm aware of. So it turned out that Korf, in later life, became close friends with an American president named Richard Nixon. In fact, he has even reported to have influenced Nixon to a degree on some of his policies. And Nixon sort of fondly referred to Korf as his rabbi. Now, the precursor to today's AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC is the most powerful foreign lobbying organization in the United States. And it is, according to Fortune magazine, the second most powerful lobbying organization in the United States of all of them. So AIPAC began, by the way, and it's just one entity. The Israel lobby, there are many, many other multi-million dollar entities. The annual budget of AIPAC is approximately $50 million. I was yesterday outside the AIPAC convention, where American political candidates always go to raise money and get endorsements. So the precursor to AIPAC came in 1939 with something called the American Zionist Emergency Council, AZEC. By 1943, AZEC had $500,000 at a time when a nickel bought a loaf of bread. Within not too many years, it had access to a far larger fund that eventually had the kind of money that in today's dollars is the equivalent of $1 billion with which to manipulate American society. They used it well. They targeted every sector of American society: congressmen, Christian clergy, editors, professors, both business and labor, Jewish war veterans specifically. Because during all this time I'm describing, pretty much all this time, most Jewish Americans were not Zionists. The large majority for many years had nothing to do with Zionism. Some were even actively anti-Zionist. So that sector of our population had to be propagandized just as much as the rest of us, and was done so even more intensively. There were hundreds of local committees around the country. They funded books and made them bestsellers. They were selling thousands of copies. Their petition and letter of writing campaigns, etc. They also work to manufacture Christian support. There were two Christian groups that were organized, and they were given money to push this in the Christian community to make, you know, sort of convert Christians to becoming Zionists and support the Zionist project to take over Palestine. Now, during all of this time, there was a great deal of diverse opposition to Zionism among different parts of our country. Some of the most distinguished and celebrated Christian clergy were opposed to Zionism for religious and moral reasons. American Christian leaders in the Middle East were opposed to Zionism. Some of them even traveled to the Paris Peace Talks to specifically advocate on behalf of Arabs, advocating for self-determination of the Arab peoples. That's what Woodrow Wilson was enunciating at the Paris Peace Talks. One of the most distinguished Dead Sea scholars, Miller Burroughs, wrote a wonderful book called Palestine is Our Business. In it, he talked about the American responsibility to uphold human rights for Palestinians. It's an excellent, very moving book. And yet, for writing that book, he was called anti-Semitic, even though he had a life history of interfaith relations and opposing all bigotry. Also opposed to Zionism was the American Council for Judaism. Rabbi Elmer Berger and Alfred Lilienthal wrote excellent books opposing and exposing Zionism. Lilienthal in particular wrote a number of excellent books and had very few people know about those books. They're very worth reading. The governmental establishment opposed Zionism year after year. Beginning with President Taft, the Secretary of State opposed it. Under Woodrow Wilson, he sent a commission to Palestine to investigate the feasibility of creating a Jewish state in Palestine. The Kincaid Crane Commission came back and with a very powerful report and said that that would be a grave trespass on the rights of the people there. Zionism should be abandoned. But their report was buried and had little impact, partly through the help of Louis Brandeis. Diplomats, the Pentagon, intelligence agencies gave report after report, memo after memo, advising against supporting Zionism, saying time after time that it would jeopardize American interests, that it would be bad for Americans, and in some cases they even said that it was against American principles. I won't go through all of these, they're in my book, but there are many, many, many statements and studies that they did, both the diplomats, CIA, etc. But Harry Truman, like all politicians, like his opponent, Thomas Dewey, was more interested in winning an election than in doing the right thing. And he said, "I'm sorry, gentlemen, but I have to answer to hundreds of thousands who are anxious for the success of Zionism. I do not have hundreds of thousands of Arabs among my constituents." Even though his Secretary of State, General George Marshall, the famous Marshall, had told Truman that he wouldn't even vote for him if he sacrificed American interests just for an election. Then in 1947, the British finally gave up. There was so much violence, their empire was pretty much coming to an end, and they turned the question of Palestine over to the United Nations to solve. The UN at that time could have affirmed their bedrock principle, their charter principle, the core principle of democracy, which is self-determination of peoples. The people that lived in Palestine could have voted their own government, created their own country. But instead of doing that, because of bribes and threats well documented, the General Assembly voted a partition recommendation in which 55% of Palestine would be given to Israel, to a Jewish state, and the Palestinians would be left with about 45%. Even after decades of immigration and trying to take over the land, the Jewish population was only 30%, and yet they're getting 55% under this plan. And the land ownership is interesting to look at, because many people are led to believe and have been told, well, they bought that land. Well, they tried to. You can dispossess people legally by buying up the land and getting rid of them that way. They tried to do that, but they failed. They increased Jewish ownership significantly. It was originally very urban and about 1%. So they got it up to about, at most, 8%. Most historians said that the Jewish ownership at this time was approximately 5 or 6%. So a group that owned about 8% of the land was going to get 55%. This has no force of law, but this was the recommendation. Now, as we know, the more unjust a situation, quite likely the more unjust it is, the more violence that ensues. So rather than bringing peace or resolving the situation, it, I think, did the opposite. That there was then the war that Israel calls its war of independence, and the Palestinians call it al-Nakba, the catastrophe. It was a massive humanitarian catastrophe. At least 750,000 men, women, and children were very ruthlessly forced off their land. There were many, many massacres. Most Americans didn't know this was going on, but one American journalist tried to tell Americans about it. Her name was Dorothy Thompson. According to the Britannic Encyclopedia, Dorothy Thompson was one of the most famous journalists of the 20th century. I think they even named her the most important female journalist of the 20th century. She was truly amazing. She had a great, but I had never heard of her. Most of us had never heard of this most famous woman journalist. She had a radio program that was listened to by millions of Americans. She had a newspaper column that was in newspapers all across the United States. She was such a celebrity that there was a play loosely patterned on her life in which she was played by Katharine Hepburn, and a Broadway play in which she was played by Lauren Bacall. She was an amazing journalist. In the 1930s, she had been a foreign correspondent in Germany. She was one of the first journalists to raise the alarm about Hitler. And in fact, she was the first foreign correspondent to be ejected by Hitler. Because of that, she was very sympathetic to Zionism. But then after the war and after Israel was created, she went over to see this wonderful new Jewish state that had been created. And she discovered, of course, hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees living under extremely harsh conditions, many dying every day, very harsh conditions. And she began to speak about them and to write about them. And for doing that, for telling about these people, she lost her radio show. She lost her newspaper column. She lost her fame for telling about these people. And she was, as her biographer put it, she was erased from history. And now today, if I tried to write a magazine article from some of the information in my book, as would be, you know, a common thing to do, and have it published by a popular history magazine, maybe something like American History Magazine, it would not get published. Now, how do I know that? Because several years ago, we tried to place a paid advertisement in American History Magazine, not for my book, for another book by a 91-year-old a retired American congressman. By the way, as I'm sure you know, advertising is the lifeblood of magazines. They're desperate for advertising. But we were told that they would not publish our paid advertisement. Their owner, Eric Weider, told us that he would not ever publish any paid advertisement from our organization, Council for the National Interest, because we were, as he said, anti-Israel. And in fact, he volunteered, they would not publish any advertising from us in any of the newspapers that they owned, which is virtually every popular history magazine in the United States, is owned by Weider Associates. Let's remember, Israel-Palestine is the core issue of the Middle East. It has been the core issue of the Middle East for almost 70 years now. Our invasion of Iraq was driven by Israel partisans on behalf of Israel neoconservatives in the Bush administration. This was written about openly in the Israeli media, unlike the American media. So we invaded Iraq, killed thousands of Iraqis, destroyed that country and left it in a shambles. So then the chaos and anarchy and tragedy, of course, spread across borders. And we have Syria in extreme turmoil, massive numbers of refugees fleeing, some of them not making it. And then we look at Iran. Some years ago, some Israel partisans working for Netanyahu and Douglas, very high-level Americans, such as Douglas Feith, who was Deputy Undersecretary of State of the Defense in the Pentagon, Douglas Feith and some others, had written a position paper for Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel. This was before he was Prime Minister. About the concerns Israel would have, sort of a position paper, about what they needed to be concerned about. And in that paper, they said there are three countries Israel needs to be concerned about because potentially, at some point in the future, they could be of danger to Israel. And those three countries were Iraq, Syria, and Iran. So then, for many years, we have been hearing about Iran and how dangerous it is to Americans, even though our intelligence agencies again and again have found that there's no evidence. No evidence whatsoever that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon, but it is supposedly a danger to us. And there was the same groups that pushed the invasion of Iraq are pushing us to invade Iran and similarly destroy another country. There was an advertisement in the New York Times several years ago, a full-page advertisement demonizing Iran, making it seem dangerous to us, Ahmadinejad in particular. And in the bottoms of that four-page ad, there were the icons and the names of the groups that had paid for that ad that put it in. And I put the names over on the left side so that you could read who it was that was pushing this demonization of Iran. This has been going on for year after year. It's gotten worse. We see the results in Belgium now. We see the increased extremism and violence. And this will grow worse, and is growing worse, unless we learn the facts, unless we share the facts with others, and unless we speak out. If we don't do that, it will get worse. If we do speak out, we can and will stop it.
You have been listening to a speech by Allison Weir, founder and director of the organization If Americans Knew. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive, go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening. And we hope you will join us again next Sunday when we will feature Middle East scholar Muin Ronani speaking at Tufts University. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.